Welcome to The Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. On the day back in February when I recorded this interview, I was having some major internet problems that resulted in really poor audio quality. And even after spending a lot of time trying to clean it up, I couldn't get the recording to sound good enough for me to feel comfortable releasing it. And this was more than a little disappointing because I thought the interview was pretty interesting. Now, in the interim, I've upgraded my software and become at least a little more adept at audio post-production. The quality is still less than I'd like, which is why I'm not posting this as a regular Wednesday interview, but as a sort of a bonus episode. Also, this episode will be uninterrupted by sponsor ads. We do, however, have two sponsors this week, and I know you're probably tired of hearing me say this, but it's important. The money we get by doing ads is by far the key element in keeping the show afloat financially. And of course, they're only going to continue sponsoring us if listeners like you end up checking them out and using our special URLs and promo codes, so they know that supporting us is a good deal for them. Now, our first sponsor is Dollar Shave Club, where, for a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. And after that, your razors are just a few bucks a month. That's a $15 value for only $5. In your first month's box, you get a weighty handle, a full cassette of four Executive cartridges, and a tube of shave butter. You can only get this offer now by going to dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. That's dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. Our second sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the quick and easy way to buy tickets for live events. Politics Guys listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just go to SeatGeek.com or download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code Politics Guy, that's all one word and no S. I don't know why, but there you go. And again, that's promo code Politics Guy for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. As always, we really appreciate your support. And now, with all these preliminaries out of the way, on to the interview. My guest today is Sasha Eisenberg, a political journalist whose work has appeared in Slate, Washington Monthly, The Atlantic, and lots of other places. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Politics and the author of multiple books, including the widely praised The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, which Politico called Moneyball for Politics. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
You know, The Victory Lab is a really interesting look at how modern political campaigns work. And I'm wondering, what led you to write it?
Yeah, well, thank you. I guess there's sort of two strands of curiosity that got me there. The first is that I was spent some part of my early career as a political reporter in Philadelphia. I was a writer for Philadelphia Magazine. And one of the things that I think becomes sort of foundational to your interest as a reporter when you come about in that environment is an attention to voter contact and field and targeting that that some of my peers who, covered politics in states where television was cheaper or where there were more traditional partisan divides didn't. And so, I spent a lot of time talking to people who weren't, political consultants or operatives who weren't bragging to me about how many points they had on TV, but were telling me how many vans they had the night before election day to get their people to the polls. And because you're in a sort of one-party town, partisanship is not the natural predictor or sorter that that campaigns use to find their voters. And people are looking at sort of far more granular distinctions in the electorate, within even racial groups or geographic zones. And so I was just alert to a certain corner of politics that I think until recently got really short shrift from political reporters who tended to be drawn to talk to media consultants or pollsters whose research informed what TV ads said or what candidates would say in their events. And I was naturally comfortable talking to tacticians, people who either dealt with direct mail, voter contact in the field, stuff that was targeted at an individual level. And it turns out that's where a lot of the innovation has been at the time, unbeknownst to me when I was in Philadelphia. But recently, that's where a lot of the innovation has been. And then the other thing that sort of came up was I just always had a skepticism that grew out of talking to political professionals who could never really explain to me how or why they knew the things that they claimed were successful or useful as tactics actually were. And I sort of always felt like you ask one or two follow-up questions to people about how or why do you know that, or how or why do you think that's true? And you realize that it was anecdote or folk wisdom or inertia that kind of led them to do what they did. And so when I'd been aware of the fact that academics had been doing field experiments in campaigns, but it was only after the 2008 election that I learned that people in the political world, practitioners were paying attention to the research that was coming out of political science and had begun to do in rather ambitious ways their own experiments. And I kind of fell into this subculture of geeks in 2009 who were doing both experiments and kind of advanced analytics on the targeting front. And that led me to realize that there really had been a revolution afoot that that had changed what campaigns were doing.
You mentioned political science, and I'm, of course, a political scientist, and I have a physicist friend who always jokes that political science isn't a real science. And so I'm wondering, are you saying that there is, in fact, some sort of a science to running a successful campaign then?
Sure. I mean, I would say that the of all the things campaigns do, the from what candidates say in their tweets now to which door you knock on and what you do when you get there, only a small fraction of total campaign activity is, I think, informed by the type of empirical knowledge that we would call scientific or informed by scientistic thought. But you go back 20 years and there was nothing. At best, there were only the most, wishful or spurious correlations that were driving us to assume that you put that ad on TV and you get this result in the polls. The number of things that are possible to measure with that type, with what we would think of as scientific accountability remain very small. But there's this sort of realm of stuff that where you can, individually target communications. And through the use of randomized control trials, measure whether certain groups change their behaviors or attitudes as a result of targeted contact. And so, these things that there were sort of scattered efforts at field experiments throughout the 20th century that I recount in my book. But it was really in 1998 when these two political scientists then at Yale, Don Green and Alan Gerber, went out in the streets of New Haven, and they randomly assigned voters into four groups to get a nonpartisan get out the vote message. And one group got a knock on the door, and another group got a phone call, and a third group got a postcard, and one group was a control group. And afterwards, because we have unlike a lot of countries on Earth, very good voter registration records that track who voted and who didn't that are publicly available, they could go and see, what the effect of the stimulus was. And they found that, the people who got the knock on the door voted at a much higher rate than those who didn't get anything. The people who got the mail had a small but appreciable increase, and the people who got the phone call had basically nothing. And that kind of opened up this idea that, hey, we can take the tools of science, namely experiments, and start applying them at least to the parts of campaigns where you can do that kind of, deliberate experimental design where you assign different voters to get different types of treatments and hold out a control group and then measure the effect either on turnout or registration rates or if you poll appropriately on opinions.
For a long time, the conventional wisdom, at least among a lot of political scientists, has been that to win elections, you have to appeal to those voters in the middle. But it seems to me that lately campaigns seem to be abandoning that approach, and they're focusing a lot more to turning out their bases as opposed to reaching to the middle. And I'm wondering, number one, if you'd agree with that, and if so, why you think that's become more common in modern campaigns.
I think that's definitely true at the presidential level. There obviously is a lot of variance depending on geography, the salience of the election, the composition of the electorate. There are some places where, you know, the simple math is that a Democrat could not just mobilize his or her way to victory, or a Republican cannot mobilize his or her way to victory. But I do think definitely at the presidential level, we are seeing this, and there are a few reasons for it. You know, one is that the combination of polarization and sorting, about which political scientists have far more to say than I do, but the idea that, you know, far more, we with the consequence that far more of the electorates are locked in, generally moves just the balance of voters whom you can persuade versus those whom you can mobilize or register and mobilize dramatically in a different direction. So, you know, just take a really simple benchmark of this. In 1984, I think something like 28 or 29% of voters reported splitting their tickets. They voted for a Democrat at the top of the ticket and a Republican somewhere down the ballot, or as was the case in 1984, most likely vice versa. And by 2000, that was under 10%. You know, you talk to the pollsters. This year might have been a little bit of an anomaly, but you talk to pollsters in 2012. You know, they did not think that more than 8, 10, maybe 12% of the electorate's opinions were ever really in flux. People were locked in early to Obama and Romney. And so, you know, so you take that 10%, they're being bombarded with television ads and free communication and direct mail and digital advertising. People aren't ignoring them. But there's a lot you can do with the remaining 90% of the population, and it appears a lot of room for growth among, you know, infrequent, non-habitual voters, about whom we know a lot more, because there's a lot more data available about those voters that's easily accessible than was 15, 20 years ago. And now we have this kind of scientific basis that tells us, hey, you can increase somebody's likelihood of voting by several percentage points by having this type of conversation from a well-trained volunteer at their doorstep. And so, you know, campaigns are looking and saying, hey, there are a lot more of these types of targets than there used to be as a proportion of the electorate. We know who they are in a far more granular way. We don't just have to target them by precinct or by big demographic groups. Like, we're going to go to African-American women 18 to 30. We can actually find, you know, the African-American women 18 to 30 who don't regularly vote in presidential elections and just target them, so it can be far more efficient. And then we have there's a far clearer, you know, playbook or set of best practices for how, whether it's over the phone, through direct mail, at the doors, now through types of targeted digital contact, you can actually change that person's behavior. And so a lot more of politics is focused, a lot of media coverage assumes that campaigns are fundamentally about opinion change. A lot more of what campaigns are doing, as you suggest, is really now about behavior modification. It's not about getting people to come over to your side. It's about getting them to do something that they're not used to doing.
Sure. And that makes sense, because it's a lot easier to do that than to get someone to change their mind. There's a lot of political science research suggesting that, for sure. You know, so what in general do we know about what gets people to the polls? I mean, what are the most effective things that campaigns do?
So the most effective thing we've ever seen measured came about in an experiment that was run in 2006 in Michigan before a gubernatorial primary, where a local consultant, a direct mail vendor named Mark Grebner, partnered with Don Green and Alan Gerber at Yale, and they ran an experiment. They randomly assigned Michigan voters to get one of several different types of get-out-the-vote mail. These were nonpartisan letters, and it said something like, you know, one of them said something like, "Dear Sasha, your history as a voter is a publicly available document on file at the Macomb County Board of Elections. Here is your history as a voter. You did vote in the 2004 presidential election. You did not vote in the 2004 state primary. You did vote in the 2003 school board election. You did not vote in the 2002 county election. And here are the other people on your block and whether or not they voted in those same elections. And there was a grid with your neighbors and their own vote histories. And then there was a threat. You know, there's another election coming up, and afterwards we'll send everybody an updated set of these records. This increased turnout among the people who received it by 28%. It also got the guy who sent it, whose name was the return address, death threats. Both of which were pretty good indicators that this was potent in a way that, you know, a lot of the normal, like, League of Women Voters knocks on your door thing isn't. And, you know, this was – this idea of social pressure, as it's called, is something that was pretty familiar to social the idea that you let people know what their peers are doing, and in this case, let them know that their individual behavior can be, you know, surveilled. Even judged, in this case with a pretty heavy hand of what some people call blackmail, that can be an incredibly potent driver to get people to vote. That, you know, and this was one of several trends that really undermined a lot of the traditional kind of League of Women Voters thinking, which is like either, you know, make a kind of rational argument for how their vote will make a difference, which most people realize, I mean, if you're mathematically rational about it, you realize it's actually not that rational to vote. It's incredibly cost intensive, and the benefits are rare and are obscure and diluted. Or that a lot of the traditional appeals to sort of, you know, civic responsibility don't seem to be big drivers of individual level behavior. And so a lot of what we've seen campaigns do in the 10 years since that that experiment was run has been trying to find ways to channel the psychological power that it represents while trying to get rid of the backlash. And so you now see a far gentler version of this, something where either on a phone call or knock on the door, a letter, you know, they'll come and say, "Sasha, I see that you voted in the 2012 election, and I want to thank you for taking the time to vote. Another election, or thank you for being a good citizen. There's another election coming up, and I'm hoping afterwards I can once again thank you for your good citizenship." You know, and this is a positive message that, you know, doesn't usually redound to death threats. People like delivering it because it's constructive and thankful, but it's still playing with the same psychological thing. Hey, I know whether or not you vote. Do you want to be seen by the people around you as one of the good people or one of the deadbeats? And so a lot of the most promising stuff gets away from, you know, it's really informed by behavioral science. It's, you know, there's a huge, you know, and economists are obviously working on this well ahead of most political scientists, but the idea that, you know, there are a lot of decisions that people make that are functionally subrational or not rational, and that these small nudges can have a huge impact on, you know, in the case of what behavioral economists care about, investing decisions or saving, stuff like that, and, you know, selecting insurance plans, and that you can use similar types of nudges to get people to take this, you know, this kind of optional participation in civic society, which is voting.
Let's flip it around. Are there any common campaign practices that actually aren't very effective?
I think there is reason to be what I'd say generally is knowing the things that do work. I think we have reason to be suspicious of a lot of what the media and some campaign professionals talk up as having anywhere near the impact that it gets in public attention. And a lot of this won't be surprising to political scientists. But yes, persuasion is really hard. And once you move people, keeping them there is really hard and demanding. So I think a lot of what media coverage suggests will have a durable impact on opinion. A single gaffe, a single ad, or run of ads. I think we should be skeptical of kind of all of that being as potent as certainly day-to-day media coverage would have you believe. And then there are a lot, there's the evidence on this is mixed, but stuff like yard signs, I think that there is some decent evidence that they do absolutely nothing. There is a fair bit of evidence that suggests in certain narrow circumstances they can have an impact on name recognition and vote share. In that case, it's not as though we have a binary yard signs never work or yard signs always work. But even just having a body of research led leads at least kind of curious, intellectually honest campaign managers, and there are a few, to ask questions about efficiency and measurement that weren't always kind of, it was like we checked that we're opening a campaign office. Let's get the yard signs. Let's get the bumper stickers. Let's put out the mailers. Let's do this. And the fact that, we know a lot more about what makes a good direct mail piece and what makes a good yard sign. But because we know that, a smart campaign manager can start to say, okay, like, what am I trying to accomplish with this particular tactic? How would I try to measure its success? And I think that, one of the things you start to see in campaigns is campaigns that are skeptical that yard signs are going to move votes for them, for example, now think, okay, well, it's a good investment because it gets volunteers into the offices, and volunteers are worth – it's worth spending $2 on a yard sign, not because it gets me a return in votes, but because if it gets somebody into an office, I can generate X number of voter contacts, and I know that every one out of seven of those will mobilize a new vote. And so I do think that you get a kind of, more effective kind of instrumental thinking about how these things fit together because you have, this even lumpy body of knowledge about what works and what doesn't.
What about campaign consultants? I mean, there are some people who say campaign consultants just are completely ripping off their candidates. They push for these big money ad campaigns, and their main effect is really to line the consultant's pocket, since they typically get paid a percentage of whatever the campaign spends. And so do you think traditional political consulting is kind of a racket?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of people whose jobs in politics would be classified as consultants because they're not staffers and who are not being paid on a commission basis. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that paying people on a commission does not create the right incentives for them to give good strategic advice. And since a lot of campaigns, part of the problem is not just that your TV buyers, that the people who make the ads are often the same people who place the ads, who buy the airtime, and that they're being paid on commission, that's a problem in and of itself. Traditionally, those people are also playing some sort of general consultant or chief strategist role. So they are making determinations about the campaign plan, about the budget, are often the loudest voice in strategy meetings or in the candidate's ear about what to do. And so they very much have a thumb on the scale. And they're not, the kind of joke is, right, if they're getting 5 or 10 or 15% of the plays, of course the solution to everything is always going to be a TV ad. And if you ask a direct mail guy who doesn't actually get paid a commission but gets paid to produce and target mail pieces, that person's going to say that the solution to everything is a mail piece. And so the incentive structure is off on those. One of the people I wrote about in the book at some length, Dave Carney, who was a very close advisor to basically was Rick Perry's top political guy from 1998 when he ran for lieutenant governor onward to his presidential campaign. And Carney brought in those political scientists from Yale, even though he suspected that they were you know, Ivy League pinkos to get them to do experiments within his campaign. But and one of the, you know, things that Carney did early with Perry was to insist that he would get paid a monthly retainer. I don't know, it was $20,000, something like that, $30,000 a month. Not small money, but to him and his small firm, but then get a win bonus afterwards instead of getting and you know, and the idea would be that he was a general consultant. He wasn't selling any other services to the campaign. He brought in the pollster and the ad maker and the direct mail person and the field people and the phone guy. And you know, the idea was that then Perry and Perry's treasurer could trust him as an honest broker among all those services. You know, a little bit like a contractor at a construction site. If the carpenter is also the general contractor, you're going to get like a bathtub made out of wood, right? So I think that writing off all political consultants is rotten. I think overlooks the fact that the candidates and their close circle of sort of permanent advisors can be a lot more savvy about how they structure the business relationships with consultants, so as to avoid the kind of worst pathologies of the profession.
You know, there are some political scientists who say that the media just focuses far too much on campaigns in general, and that really campaigns don't matter nearly as much as most journalists think they do. And the argument is generally focuses on something called fundamentals, you know, things that have nothing to do with campaigns, the state of the economy, how long one party's held the White House, that sort of thing. What do you think about that? Do you think that we have this tendency to overestimate the importance of campaigns in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, and for a moment, I'll speak on behalf of the whole media. Yeah, I think definitely media coverage does that, and by extension, I think probably, you know, public views of campaigns do that. I'm an observer and consumer of the Do Campaigns Matter debate. I'm not really a participant in it because I'm not doing any research that's trying to quantify the aggregate impact on campaigns. I would say often I feel like the debate in political science boils down to can X campaign effect explain the outcome, which is to me a kind of silly question, which is to say that if the race was decided by 2 points, then campaigns matter, but if the race was decided by 9 points, and campaigns didn't matter because the campaign can only explain 2% of the variance. I mean, that's sort of silly because the campaign is having the same effect. It's just that in some cases it proves determinative or not. And we know a lot of things that do have. I find especially, you know, a lot of the research I write about in the book was sort of supercharged after 2000 because the results of the election were so close that people looked at Florida and said, okay, things that make me 1 or 2 or 3% more effective or efficient are worth investing in because I just saw a presidential election resolved by that margin. We're now obviously in the shadow of another election decided by, you know, small spread out margins. So we know even the people who are arguing for the fundamentals concede that campaigns can have often an effect of a few points. It seems to me that understanding what's happening in those few points is important to the media and the public, not just to practitioners. The other thing which I believe strongly is that how candidates run, and both how candidates win and how candidates tell themselves that they won, is really important to understanding how they govern, to understanding how parties organize themselves, to understanding which interest groups have influence or leverage as a result. I mean, Trump is an extreme case study in that he is constantly rehearsing the story of his victory in public afterwards. But every president comes in and often slightly adjusts or amends a narrative of how they won. You know, the story of, you know, the Obama reelection was we mobilized the existing Democratic coalition. It explains a lot of why Obama's second term didn't have the same, you know, kind of sweeping gestures towards winning over the center and center right that he did after his first term. And a lot of that was he saw where his coalition was, and Hillary Clinton tried to build off of that coalition. To understand, you know, that arc of the modern Democratic Party, and how she ends up strategically running, positioning herself in 2016, to understanding what Obama's legislative priorities were in 2013, you need to understand the tools that his campaign used. Even if they were only moving 1 or 2 or 3 points, they were focused, you know, using these, you know, get out the vote tactics. They credit their victory to, you know, fully mobilizing African Americans, young Latinos, unmarried women, women of color. That explains why the Democratic Party has become so much more about certain types of identity politics than was 20 years ago, when the tools were far more, and the electorate lent itself to tools were far more focused on persuasion. You know, Bill Clinton ran a different campaign than Hillary Clinton, and, you know, so much of, to go back to your question earlier, you know, fixated on winning over swing voters, in part because the electorate was different, in part because the tools were different. And so we need to understand what campaigns do and what they tell themselves about what they have done, even if it does not affect uniquely affect the outcome of an election.
So let's talk a little bit about 2016. I mean, Hillary Clinton supposedly had this ultra sophisticated high tech operation. Donald Trump seemed to actually actively dismiss the importance of big data. And you know, there are some people in kind of these election aftermaths saying that, well, the Democrats are relying too much on big data and they're forgetting the importance of crafting a compelling narrative. What's your take on this?
I don't think those are in natural, inevitable tension the way that a lot of folks lay them out. And you know, and to be fair, you know, a lot of those arguments are being made by consultants who have a, you know, once again, a vested interest in that debate. And that the kind of data versus message thing is usually a proxy for a mobilization versus persuasion debate, which often is being waged by kind of tacticians versus strategists. So there are a lot of fault lines here. I think that Hillary Clinton did have, as best I could tell from my reporting, it was an incredibly sophisticated campaign in terms of the analytic structure that she had built and the field organization that she had built that was being informed by analytics. It's pretty clear now that there was – her numbers were just bad. And you know, some version of the garbage in, garbage out logic of analytics applies, you know, and I think – we're still waiting for voter files to come back. And so how much of this was a systematic surveyor, whether sort of systematic non-response, whether it was people lying to pollsters, whether it was poor modeling of turnout. Understanding, I still don't think we really understand where they went wrong, but, you know, her internal analytics numbers, which were guiding every, you know, basically every decision the campaign made, macro and micro, were off by something like 7 points in Wisconsin. I think that they probably made a lot of very rational decisions off of bad numbers that led them to, you know, overinvestment and underinvestment decisions that obviously in retrospect were really poor. I'm not sure that they overinvested in analytics. Something just got really wrong in there. You know, I'm not sure that the Soviet Union overinvested in nuclear power in the 1980s as a matter of policy, but selling at Chernobyl didn't work out the way it should have, right? And so, you know, now separately, there is a critique that she did not have, you know, a good economic message, that her campaign was too uniquely focused on, you know, sort of separately upscale, moderate center right voters at the expense of kind of downscale, blue collar whites, that she went after, you know, the upscale whites with, you know, a kind of character and culture critique of Trump, at the expense of, either a more economically a critique of Trump's own business practices, and him not being a sort of champion of the working man type frame, or that, to some degree that she was too uniquely negative across the board and did not generate a kind of positive economic message about what her presidency would do. I understand the logic behind all of these. They all seem quite reasonable. I also, you know, the challenge for everybody who ran against Donald Trump in the primaries and the general election was this, and the media too, was this embarrassment of riches. The guy was a target rich environment. You could come up, you know, you could think of 30 new ways to run campaigns at him a day, because he had so many vulnerabilities. He manufactured new ones. I don't think it is self-evidently the case. It's become a lot easier in retrospect, obviously, for people to argue, hey, you guys got so obsessed with running against Trump, you know, to college educated women instead of talking to, you know, blue collar men about what you do on job creation. Look, the morning after that Access Hollywood tape comes out, I wouldn't have argued that, hey, ignore that. You're getting distracted from, you guys should be running on your, you know, why aren't you out talking about industrial policy today? So, you know, I think that this is a really important argument for Democrats to have. A lot of it, I think, is, you know, uniquely related to the questions about messaging against Trump, who was always a very difficult candidate for Republicans and Democrats to run against, than it is necessarily a usefully broad systemic or cultural critique of how campaigns run.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I know we're running a little short on time, but I wanted to mention that after you wrote The Victory Lab, you went off into kind of a different direction, right? Your latest book, Outpatients on Medical Tourism, I think it came out last year. And I'm wondering if you could maybe say a little bit about that and maybe any other projects you're working on currently.
Sure. You know, so my first book was about the global fish business, about, it was called The Sushi Economy. So I've written a bit about globalization and, I guess, you know, kind of quirky corners of international commerce now. For Outpatients, I spent a bunch of time mostly with dentists in Hungary, Hungary has begun to sort of market itself as the dental capital of Europe. You know, and there's this kind of organic story that begins before the fall of the Iron Curtain, where Hungary relaxed its borders and allowed in the late 80s and allowed Austrians to come across. And folks in Vienna realized that, you know, for a 45-minute drive over the border, you could get at costs significantly cheaper than they would be in Vienna, basic dental services. And it turns out that Hungary had this kind of perfect combination of, you know, traditional Prussian medical education, the Soviet style system had created a centrally planned healthcare system where that ensured that there were local practices, both medical and dental, evenly distributed across the population. And so these border towns ended up being frequented by initially Austrian, then German and Italian patients who were paying a fraction of what they would at home. And then, you know, you go back, then that happens sort of organically throughout the 90s. And then in the early 2000s, Hungary joins or begins the process of joining the EU. The EU deregulates its airspace, and Budapest's airport becomes filled with these low-cost carriers like Wizz Air and Ryanair and whatever. And all of a sudden, instead of, you know, a 1.5 hour driving radius from Northwest Hungary being your sort of catchment zone for dental customers, patients. Hungarian dentists are looking at a 1.5 hour flying radius, and it's getting you, you know, to Dublin and Moscow and throughout southeastern Europe. And all of a sudden, Budapest starts to boom as a destination for this. And it becomes this really interesting, you know, I picked that one corner of dental tourism as a kind of, you know, because I kind of thought it was amusing at first, as a kind of case study. But what, you know, you have medical tourism going in all sorts of directions around the world, and what it functionally is a form of individual level or kind of individual agent level arbitrage of disjunction between national healthcare systems. You know, you see this, you know, between the U.S. and Canada. U.S. has a lot of specialists with a lot of availability, and so wealthy Canadians who have rationed care and can't get to a specialist quickly, but are willing to spend the money, come to the U.S. And Americans who want to get cheaper prescription drugs go to Canada. And each of those is a reflection that each country has made a set of policy trade-offs around its healthcare system, some prioritizing coverage, some prioritizing costs, some prioritizing innovation and research. And it's become increasingly available to the middle classes of at least the developed world that you can, you know, use air travel and the movement of currencies to kind of arbitrage this to your advantage. And so I found medical tourism was kind of a, you know, I ended up reporting this on the, you know, during sort of phase two or three of the Obamacare debate. And it was really interesting to be, on one hand, have a foot in American politics and watch, you know, people feel very hopeless. Some people feel very hopeless or at least subjected to the decisions of federal and state policymakers about their healthcare options. But then also realize in large parts of the world, people are seeing themselves as not being constrained by the decisions that their national governments make, and often seeing in the decisions their national governments make and other national governments make, the opportunity to exploit kind of differences in policymaking. And so anyway, so that was a short book that I put out last year, and I'm approaching the end of a long run working on another book project. I'm writing a political, legal, social history of the battles over gay marriage in the United States, which is you know, probably the single biggest change on a domestic policy issue in my lifetime. And I've certainly been around at the margins of the politics of this for a long time, and I have no idea how we got from there to here so quickly and with relatively little fuss all told. And so I'm writing a book that will be out next year in 2018 that hopefully offers a narrative account of the whole arc of that.
Oh, well, that sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to reading that one. Well, I know we're already a bit over, so I just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to come in and talk with me today.
Thanks, Michael. I enjoyed it.
That's it for this Politics Guys interview. We hope you liked what you heard and that you'll check out our sponsors. First is Dollar Shave Club, where for a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, your razors are just a few bucks a month, a $15 value for only $5. And in your first month's box, you get a weighty handle, a full cassette of four Executive cartridges, and a tube of Shave Butter. You can only get this offer now by going to dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. That's dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. Our second sponsor is SeatGeek, the quick and easy way to buy tickets for live events, where Politics Guys listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just go to SeatGeek.com or download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code PoliticsGuy. That's one word with no S, so just PoliticsGuy. I don't know what happened to the S, but there you go. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought for us that you want to share, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where you can message us and where we post throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. We'll be back with a new show on Sunday. We hope you'll join us.